This interview is being conducted on November 3rd, 2007, with Mr. Niall Stafford at the Indian Prairie Library in Darien, Illinois. My name is Deb Barrett. Mr. Stafford was born on April 1st, 1916, on a farm in Huron County, Michigan. He was the owner of several movie theaters in Michigan and then worked in real estate in Illinois until his retirement in 1977. And he learned of the Veterans History Project from Melanie Wicker, another volunteer on this project, who is joining us today. Mr. Stafford has kindly consented to be interviewed for this project. Here is his story. Niall, when you were, what was your life like just before you joined the service, just before you went into the service?
I was 25 years old, and I was a manager of a movie theater.
Okay.
I was a partner in two theaters, and I had my partners were a World War I veteran, and my brother, who was 2 years younger than I.
Okay. Were you living at home? Did you have an apartment? Were you single, married?
I was single then, and living with my mother. I had lost my father many years before.
Okay. So you were 25, and were you drafted? Did you enlist?
I enlisted. Well, after Pearl Harbor in December of 41, I enlisted the following April, 42.
Okay.
And it was a little while before they called me. You know, I enlisted, signed the paper, but it was a little while before they called me into active service.
And the branch you enlisted in?
In the Air Force.
Okay. And what prompted you to enlist? Why did you enlist? Was it because of Pearl Harbor, or?
Well, you know, I might have been drafted anyway, but it wasn't happening yet. But I thought, you know, the war was on, and mm-hmm. the loyalty had to be there, and if I was able to serve my country, I should do it.
Okay. How did your family feel about your enlistment?
I think they were sorry to see me go into service, but they thought I had the right to decide what I was going to do.
Okay. And why did you choose the Air Force?
I just liked airplanes.
Okay. Did you know what you wanted to do in the Air Force?
Well, I thought I might want to be a flyer, and as the war developed and the events happened, it seemed like the three other fellows were in the service the same time I did. One was killed, two were prisoners of war in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and I was the only one that went to Asia, and so I wasn't a prisoner of war, or mm-hmm. I just had to deal with the weather in India.
Okay. So you went in, you were 25 years old, you said, when you went
yes,
in?
Yes.
Which that was a little older for the service, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was older than some.
Yeah, you were older than a lot of the men going in?
The teenagers.
Right.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. Where were you inducted?
I was inducted in the Air Force in Nashville, Tennessee. I had to go from Michigan to Nashville, and because of the Air Force, there was an Army base in Michigan, and if I went in the regular Army, I would have been inducted to Battle Creek, Michigan.
Okay.
But because I went in the Air Force, I was sent to Nashville, Tennessee.
Do you remember the name of the base?
No.
Okay, but it was in Nashville.
Yes.
Okay. What were the first days like when you were at that base? Was it a surprise to you what life was like?
Well, oh, yes.
So tell me.
Getting uniforms, and I had problems with shoes. You know, I wore a double A with shoes.
Okay.
And they didn't...
They didn't have narrow shoes.
So I had to get the size, but the wrong width. And, you know, it was just an adjustment of getting the uniforms issued and just a general introduction in the military in Nashville.
What was it like having the younger men in there with you? Were you the oldest one in your group?
No. There were older, some older.
There were some older ones than you.
Yes. People could be drafted up to the age of 40, I think.
Okay.
And if they were past 40, then that would be a reason if you were in service, you'd get out of service.
Okay.
But I'd say, I was sort of middle.
Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you got down to Tennessee, down to Memphis, what was it like when you first were first inducted? I mean, did they line you up and induct everybody at once? Did they?
Well, I think it was a process of introduction in the military. You know, checking uniforms.
Okay.
And you had to do so much walking and so much running and to get in shape for the military. It was just a basic introduction into the military.
So they issued you uniforms?
Yes.
Were you able to keep your civilian clothes with you?
No, I don't think so.
What did you do with them?
I think I sent them home.
You had to send them home. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm quite sure that's true.
Okay. What was a typical day like when you were there, when you first got there?
I was thinking it was in the fall of the year, so I guess it was not too far from the Middle West area,
right.
But maybe a little bit further south than Nashville.
Okay.
But the weather was very comparable to this area, to the Midwest, I think.
What time would they wake you up for breakfast?
I think it was 6 a.m.
Okay. And did you go right to breakfast, or did they have inspection, or did you do some exercises?
Well, I think we went directly to breakfast. I don't remember any exercises before, but after breakfast, we did jogging and a lot of this.
A lot of calisthenics?
Yeah.
Okay. Did they inspect your barracks?
Oh, yes, I think about every day. Did you make your beds and so on? Yes.
Okay. Did they have standards for how you did things?
Yes,
I think so. And what happened if somebody didn't meet the standards?
Well, I guess they just got corrected.
They heard about it.
Yeah.
So what was your barracks like? Was everybody in one room? Were they several separate rooms?
Everybody was in one room.
And what did you have for you? A bed and what else?
I think they were all double decked.
All bunk beds?
Yes, bunk beds. I think I had a lower bunk.
Okay. Foot locker?
Yes, I think so. I did have a foot locker, yes.
Okay. And what was in your foot locker?
Well, just the very, you were told what you could keep, the civilian clothes you could not keep, just the basic shaving equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Not an electric razor, I had just a safety razor.
Uh-huh.
Toilet articles, I guess you'd term it. Underwear.
Spare, extra clothes?
Yes.
Did you have a long locker for hanging clothes to, or was everything in your foot locker?
Everything in the foot locker.
Did it have to be in any certain order? Did they inspect your foot locker too, or did they just say that's yours?
I think they just left it. You kept it closed, it wasn't objectionable.
Okay. So how did they wake you up at 6 a.m.?
I was trying to think. I think there was a first sergeant. I don't know if it was a reveille bell or some places I had, other bases I had, a first sergeant came around and everybody got jolted out of bed.
it wasn't a nice, gentle note.
Oh, it was. I was at six different bases.
Okay.
I remember each one. I'm not too sure I'm doing that.
So they'd wake you up at 6 a.m.?
Yes.
And you had to get, you and everybody else had to get cleaned up, dressed, and then go off to breakfast. Did you go to breakfast together as a unit?
You
did, you all march?
Just time-wise.
Right.
You'd have a mess hall.
Right.
And you went at that time, but you didn't have to go with a group.
Okay. And what might you have for breakfast? I mean, what did they serve you?
It was sausage at the time, it was mink sausage, and quite often oatmeal. Always had coffee.
Uh-huh.
I don't think we ever had bacon there, but that's about it.
But the food was good? It was edible.
Edible.
It sustained you for the day, or for the,
yeah,
the morning.
For the morning, yeah.
So then what would you do after breakfast?
Well, we had various, I remember one time we had to jog 3 miles, you know, it's a physical, and many calisthenics.
So building up your physical stamina and strength.
Inducted into just general military process.
Right.
Military, you know, conduct. What's right and what's wrong and what's
protocol.
And,
yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And did they give you were all your classes then on military conduct and military protocol? What else did they teach you in your basic training?
Well, I think it was just you know, the general adjustment to military living.
Okay.
You behave yourself and follow the rules and what was expected of you as a military person. Obey the rules, obey orders. You know, the discipline, I think, was a good part.
Okay. And if somebody disobeyed the rules, what was the punishment? What was the discipline?
Well, they'd be reprimanded by an officer.
Right.
Or if they, you know, really got in trouble in town, they could go to the brig.
Okay. What sort of punishments did they give if it wasn't the brig, if it wasn't that serious? I mean, would the officers give them additional duties?
I remember somebody was confined to quarters for 2 days.
Like being sent to your room. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you learn any combat-related skills in basic training, or was it just adjustment to the military? Like, did you learn how to shoot or anything like that?
That came later.
Okay.
I did have gun training later, handgun training, you know, rifle.
But not in Nashville?
No.
So how long was your basic training in Nashville?
About 2 months.
Okay. And when you finished your basic training in Nashville, where did you go?
Maxwell Field, Alabama.
Okay, so that you stayed in the South, went further south.
Further south.
Okay, and what was the training for in Maxwell?
Well, it was the possibility of becoming a pilot.
Okay.
And I qualified for that pretty well, but I had a minor physical defect that sidetracked training.
Okay. So you weren't able to be a pilot. And they found this at some point during your training.
Right, and they found that, you know, I had a business experience. And
okay.
So that was needed. And well, that's why I got to tell the story of what happened after that.
So you went to, how long were you at Maxwell before they found that you couldn't be a flyer?
It was about 2 months there, too.
Okay. So when they decided you couldn't fly, but they did want your business experience, where did they send you? Did you stay at Maxwell or did you go?
To another air base in Douglas, Georgia.
Okay.
And they wanted me to know about airplanes, even though I wasn't going to be a pilot.
Okay. So what sort of training did they give you at Douglas?
Well, there was some exposure, you know, to single-engine aircraft.
Okay.
I had to ride in some, observe some, and know about, you know, emergency landings and just discipline, I guess, in aircraft.
So what was the type of work that they were going to ask you to do? Did you know at this point, or?
They were, in this time was the introduction of the B-29.
Okay.
So before that, the long-range aircraft were B-17s and B-24s. Well, the B-29 was invented, and it never had been used anywhere. So the beginning of my training from there on was the introduction to the B-29. And that's where I got things to show you.
Okay.
You know, if you want to see them.
Sure. So, and this was happening when you were in Georgia?
No, it was two bases later. I was transferred a couple more times.
So you went from Georgia to where?
Alabama.
Back to Alabama?
Yes.
Back to?
Biloxi. No, Biloxi, Mississippi.
Keesler Base, right?
Keesler Air Field, yeah. I was there for a while.
And from Keesler?
From Keesler, I went to Colorado, and this was Fort Logan, Colorado.
And that's where you saw the B-29s?
Well, that's where there was more training on, you know, how do you run an air depot.
Okay.
A B-29 had 200,000 parts, so between that base and next was Oklahoma City. We had to learn about a B-29, so let me see what I can show you about that.
Okay.
That's,
Niall has some articles here.
Just to give you some concept of what a B-29 looked like.
Okay, he has some articles here that show pictures and talk about what the B-29 was. And these are more recent articles from the Smithsonian.
Yes.
Okay. So the Air Force decided to use your business experience.
That I needed to be in administrative.
Right.
Or, this is out of sequence. With, that's the art. This man piloted that.
Paul Tibbetts, right.
Yeah, he died the day before yesterday.
Paul Tibbetts, who flew the Enola Gay, right. Yeah, he just passed away. So you got the basic military experience, but then rather than being in combat, you were doing administrative work.
Yes.
To help those who were in combat.
Yes, and to know about a B-29, the parts that were in it, and now I better go to this map.
Okay.
And you need to know what developed in the war. And so it was decided that I wasn't going to go to Europe. I was going to go to the Pacific.
Okay.
And where was the B-29 used? Well, it was decided they need the long range.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be in Asia.
Okay.
So here we are in the States, and how do we get to Asia? So the process was we went from Oklahoma City, was about there, to the East Coast.
Okay.
And it was decided that what I said before, the ships going to Europe were guarding passenger ships, supply ships.
Right.
And it was decided we had to go to India. Well, they decided, well, we should go on a British ship.
A British ship?
British ship.
Okay.
And the joke of it was, the ship they picked was called the Empress of Japan. So they decided, well, the ship used to go from the West Coast to Japan.
Right.
So they couldn't keep that name, so they, it was a British ship, so they renamed it the Empress of Scotland.
The Empress of Scotland?
Scotland, a British ship.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So that's the ship. I went overseas on it, 26,000 tons, a good ship. It's equipped for 1,200 people, but we got to take 4,000 people on the
oh,
ship.
Oh, wow.
So I'm in there, 5 bunk high.
Were they bunk, regular bunks, or were they more like the hammock type?
Hammock type.
Okay.
So every day we drew straws to see who got the top bunk. If you're in the top bunk, you didn't get punched from under there. Somebody rolling over. And so anyway.
Were these all Americans on this ship?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And all.
All Air Force, or?
All Air Force, yes.
So you were sailing across, not the Pacific, but the Atlantic?
Okay, now I wanted to tell you.
Yeah.
We went in this ship, and they said, well, you know, we got all the ships tied up going over here, so you're going to have to go unescorted to India.
Okay.
So we started out and went like this.
Southwest on the Atlantic.
And for 2 days off here, PBYs would fly over us.
What is a PBY?
It's an aircraft that will land in water.
Okay.
And they were flying over us, continual circle, looking for German submarines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we made it from here, and we landed at Cape Town.
Wow.
And this took about 6 days. And as we approached Cape Town, the porpoise was just beautiful, you know. So some of the fellows said, you've got to get up on deck. I was 5 decks down and see the porpoise. So I climbed up the 5 deck. I got up on top, and a wave came over the ship, and I was soaking wet. So I had to go right back down to my locker.
Dry off, change clothes.
Change clothes. So we were there a few days, and I had a bulletin watch, and the watch stopped. And so I went to my commanding officer and I said, you know, this is the only watch I got that stopped. And he said, well, you know, I'll get you some military people to take you into Cape Town and maybe you can get a fix. So I took it to a jeweler there, and the jeweler says, well, you know, I can fix your watch, but he said, I can't do it today. I can't get the water cleaned out of it in the day. I got to send. So he says, what's your address? said, well,
I'm on that boat.
I can't give you my address. My address is APO New York, New York. And he said, well, you know, you can take the watch, no charge, or you can leave it with me and I'll fix it and I'll send it to APO New York, New York. And I thought, well, that's the one chance I got to get the watch. So I said, okay, I'll leave it. And I paid him for fixing it. So we went on, and as we left, I got to get oriented here. As we left Cape Town, we went around Madagascar, and this took 4 or 5 days. And on that trip, we were alerted that we were being pursued by a German submarine. And everybody was upset about it. And it never really happened. But anyway, we wound up on this side of India, Bombay.
On the west coast of India.
On the west coast. And the reason was that the Japanese controlled the whole Bay of Bengal and all this area down here, including Singapore. So this ship unescorted couldn't go in there. So they wound up in Bombay. But we're going to build an air base right over here at Kragpore.
So the Japanese had the Bay of Bengal on the east coast. The Allies had the Arabian Sea on the west coast.
Yes.
And India itself, you were going to have to go to the east coast of India to build this depot.
Yes. And what you need to know was, at that time, England controlled all of India. This map doesn't show Pakistan very well.
Right.
I was there for a while, too. So I had to go clear across India by rail.
Okay.
The whole squadron. I nearly went out of my mind on that trip.
Why is that?
We were all in boxcars, 8 to a boxcar, no bunks. You just had your duffel bag. You could sleep on the floor, no latrine, no potty. You could go to a corner of the car, there was a hole out at the bottom. You wanted to go to the toilet. Well, after the third day,
I bet.
The stench in that car was awful. I almost left the military, but I thought, I'm in India, I don't know anybody. So,
well, while you were on this trip in these boxcars, how did they feed you? What did you eat?
You'd stop. In the morning, I can remember, they'd stop the train. And they'd serve you coffee and some, dried stuff. Not a toast, but a crunchy.
Okay.
No cookies.
Like a biscuit or something,
yeah,
or a scone,
yeah,
or
something they could carry on the train. And it was long enough that they had an engine on the back and an engine on the front.
Okay.
So anyway, 5 days later, we wound up at the east side of India. This base we had to build was near Calcutta.
Okay.
Which is the east side of India. And the problem was that we had to build this base for a B-29. And the B-29 took 1.625 miles for takeoff with full bomb load.
Okay.
You just watch them, they taxi, taxi, taxi. And they didn't go off like this, they just... Ooh.
It was a very gradual incline to go off, right?
Yeah. So, where do we build this base? They didn't have an air base there. So, we had a brigadier general with us, Wolf was his name, a one-star general. He met with a British general, and they decided where to build this base. We know we're going to have B-29s, but we don't have any place to put them yet. So, the two of them decided the only place to build that base was in a swamp.
In a swamp? Okay.
And I didn't have anything to do with it, being a staff sergeant. But I did ask, why are we going to the swamp? We're 7 miles out of Kragpore. no buildings around. Mm-hmm. There's all these people involved. And they said, well, we don't have to cut off any railroads. We don't interrupt any highways. We don't have to tear down any buildings. We just build the air base in the swamp. So we were 10 months clearing that swamp of snakes and brush. And a B-29 took 10 inches of...
May I have your attention, please?
A B-29 took 10 inches?
Of reinforced concrete.
Okay.
So a mile and 5/8 of that.
Oh.
And the native Indians, and I had to do with a little of it, it was up to the engineers to build it.
Right.
He said, we got lots of cement, so don't worry about that. We don't have any lumber, we don't have any steel, but we got lots of cement. So it just took days and days, and we went through the fall monsoon season trying uh-huh. to pour that concrete, and we finally got the mile and 5/8 in and some taxi strips. And so then it was decided, according to that article, that I had to run a warehouse. We had to build 6 warehouses.
Okay.
And so it's in some of this other stuff here.
So you were going to run one of the 6?
We got cement for the base of the warehouse, and but we don't have any steel. So what happened was, I didn't tell you earlier, Rommel controlled North Africa.
Uh-huh.
And while we were in this process, Rommel retreated across North Africa and left the Italian base at Libya.
Okay.
And so our engineers discovered that, and Montgomery was the British general who was
right.
pushing, that, well, those bases at Libya, we could build warehouses in India. So our engineers tore down the Italian bases, loaded them on Liberty ships, shipped them through the Red Sea, and they ran it up between Ceylon. This was shallow in here, was
right.
the problem. And then brought it overseas, so we got the framing for the warehouses.
So it recycled.
from Libya.
Recycled air bases, recycled
yeah,
buildings.
So we wound up with the cement and the frame of the warehouses. Hmm. And one of them shows in some of those pictures, no sides to the warehouses or no roof. And so our general was Curtis LeMay. He was a 2-star general then.
Okay.
And he said, somewhere he got a hold of the Minneapolis Honeywell people, and they sent masonite, 4x8 sheets of masonite, 1/4-inch thick, and that's what we did the walls of all 6 warehouses.
Okay.
No roof.
Yeah.
So there was, our supply officer was a lieutenant colonel, a very nice fellow. I got to deal with him quite a bit. And the roof of those warehouses was so hot, our GIs couldn't stand it. So we had a company of African Americans. So LeMay says, well, get the African Americans to put the roof on. We got a steel company here that makes sheets of steel for the roof of the warehouses. Well, they tried it and couldn't stand
it
either,
hot,
so
yeah.
he said, put extra soles on their shoes, and then they can stand on the hot roof. So that's what happened. We got the warehouses closed in.
Okay. Now I have a question for you. You said the Bay of Bengal was controlled by the Japanese,
yes.
but they were still able to ship through... Between
That's
Ceylon
why they
and
went
India?
Up between here.
And then they went on to land?
See, this was all Japanese. Singapore is down here somewhere.
Right.
At the foot of. Should be right there.
Right.
And yeah. we bombed Singapore quite a bit.
Okay.
And Bangkok was
Thailand, yeah.
Up here. And that's where Vito Road and so on was going.
So the Japanese controlled most of this, but there was still some room for them to, for the British ships to come in?
They called it sneaking them through between Ceylon and up here to unload that steel.
Okay.
So they did some places there that was only 12 feet of water depth, you know.
Right.
So they couldn't load the ships too heavy, but they did get the steel in. And so that, so I wound up running one of those warehouses.
Now, while you were doing this, while all this was going on, you've been to 6 different bases in the United States.
Yes.
You got shipped to India. Were you able to communicate with anybody at home during any of this time?
Yeah, you could write a letter.
Okay.
It took 2 weeks to get home.
Okay.
And 2 weeks to come back.
Were they censored?
Yes, always. Everything was censored.
Okay. Were you able to tell them even where you were, even, or were you able to tell your family where you were?
No. I cheated a little bit. My wife and I had stationery.
Uh-huh.
So we had a map. I knew I was going to this area. So we had a map of that area. And I told her I'd punch a hole in the map. So, you know, I could write a letter, it had a hole in it, and she could lay it on the on this area and tell about
where you were.
Exactly. Anyway, so I thought I was going to Chittagong, which is right up here, and
uh-huh.
We wound up in Calcutta, and we had to go 70 miles inland because the Japs controlled this, and our forces felt we don't want an air base right on the shore.
Right.
So we're moving 70 miles inland to Craigport.
So you were very close to that line between the Japanese and the Allies.
The
you
Japanese
were just in a little bit further.
Captured up in here, in Chittagong.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we were bombed by the Japanese when we...
No, you were.
Yes.
After it was built?
I remember, some of those pictures there show the barracks that we were in, grass roof barracks. And
so the... You may have taken...
Not that one. That's the V-29 only. One of the other... I think this one,
So the barracks you had in the United States were wooden barracks, and here they were grass roof barracks?
We all lived in tents.
Oh, the tents, right. The British tents?
Yes, double top British tents. That tells what I did, if you want to read that. It
says you were a supply technician in the 22nd Air Depot Group in India, supervised the issue of all vehicles used in the 20th Bomber Command. Vehicles included mobile repair units, mobile electrical units, cranes, and other equipment used in the salvage and towing of B-29 aircraft. Also had charge of the sheet metal work, supervised the work of 30 men.
Okay, that describes pretty well. And there's another.
You have a citation.
Well, that's where I was given the Bronze Star. It describes a little bit of what I did.
Pursuant to authority contained in the Army Regulation 600-45, dated September 22, 1943, as amended, and classified letter, Headquarters, 20th Air Force, dated December 16, 1944. Subject, Delegation of Administrative Responsibilities. The Bronze Star Medal is hereby awarded to Sergeant Niall W. Stafford, Air Corps, United States Army, 20th Bomber Command, for meritorious achievement in connection with military operations against an enemy of the United States, from February 14, 1944 to February 14, 1945 as Section Chief of Classes 19, 22, and 23 of the Depot Supply Squadron, Air Depot Group. Sergeant Stafford materially assisted in the planning of supply operations and construction of installations for supply operations to and from the Bomber Air Command bases in India and China. Sergeant Stafford's services reflect great credit upon himself, the Bomber Command, and the Army Air Forces. So you were very busy, and obviously your work was recognized by the Army Air Corps, the Air Force, for your work. So you said while you were there, you were living in grass thatched.
No.
I'm sorry, you were in the tents.
We lived in tents, British tents, double-top tents.
Okay.
They had double-top because of the extreme heat. And we would hit periods, and we were not far north of the equator, by the
way. Right.
And we hit areas that were terribly hot. But the double tent would sort of protect you a little bit from the sun, rather than a single-top tent would just get terribly hot. So the double top tent helped some, and some of those pictures show the side of it left open. We had one barracks that was a grass roof barracks at the end of all these tents. And once we were bombed by the Japanese, and a buddy of mine who lived in Illinois lived in that barracks. And the air raid siren went off, and so I got in the slip trench, and I thought, I remember the sergeant said, when you get bombed, don't get curious, you know, stay down.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, well, I gotta look. And I could see that one barracks with a grass roof, and the bomb came in, went off, the air raid siren went off, and I looked again. And that barracks wasn't there anymore.
It was that fast.
And my buddy was in that barracks, and I thought, he probably didn't make it.
Right.
Well, he came out of that just with scratches.
Wow.
And it just, he was okay. No bones broken, no, nothing.
Okay.
So, but the barracks
was gone.
Gone. You just wouldn't think it was possible.
So you said
another time we went through a bombing, and these 36 coolers that I had, just that bombing took place late in the evening, and the next morning one cooler came to me and he was crying, and I put my hand on him and he was telling me, and he said, you know, you should know how tough it is to go through a bombing attack with two wives. He says, one goes, he says, not that big. And he called him BB, his BB. And the other one goes, that's his BB. He says, it's tough to get through that with two wives. And I thought, I had my one wife here. Anyway.
Tell us on the record, you mentioned before talking about your staff, that there weren't enough service people, and so you had the local people.
Yes.
Explain that for us.
Well, it was decided that there were not enough military people to do all of the jobs, including the maintenance, available.
Mm-hmm.
Primary place was Europe.
Right.
So if you didn't have enough military personnel in your outfit, hire local people. So that's how I wound up with 36 coolies and 7 GIs in my section.
Okay, and you said there was a captain for them who spoke English?
Yes, 10. Each 10 coolies had a captain.
Okay.
They were the only ones that spoke English.
So when you needed something done,
you talk to the captain.
Right, and the captain would tell them.
I'll tell you another story. So one day, after the warehouses were open, and we had, in my warehouse, I had all the armor plate that goes into a D39, all the copper tubing, and rivets, and nuts, and bolts. And so one day, the colonel called me in for headquarters, my assistant. We went there, and I came back, and I looked at the warehouse stuff. There's rivets. We just got a shipment of 4,000 rivets. And in the center of that warehouse was piles of 5 rivets. And I said to the coolie captain, you know, you got the whole center of this warehouse covered with rivets. Why is that? He said, the coolie can only count to 5. So there's piles of 5 all over. We still had to count them after he got the counted.
Okay. Tell us a little more. You mentioned bombings and having slit trenches. Was that part of preparing the base, was digging those trenches? And who dug them, and how many did you have, or where were they?
Well, most places, I told you we were 7 miles out of Cragport.
Right.
So we built these warehouses and tents for our sleeping. And I had to travel locally some, so I was issued a peep. Not a jeep, but a peep.
A peep.
A peep was a single seat, four-wheel vehicle with a trunk on the back. It had a trunk like this on the back, so that I could get around. And I guess I had to use that quite a bit. Do you want to hear more stories incidents? So one of the fellows of the 7 in my outfit was Ernie Pyle.
Okay.
Not the famous Ernie Pyle.
A different Ernie Pyle.
A different Ernie Pyle. So he got me into lots of trouble. And he was from Oklahoma. He'd go into town on some vehicle, truck, get a ride, and he always got into trouble. He'd get drunk, and local women he was pursuing, so he got put in jail in Cragport. So the military came to me and said, well, you know, he's in your section, you better come and testify. So I went into town, and I said, well, you know, he's really a nice guy. He just chases women and he gets drunk. And so I said, you know, he's not a villain. He's
right.
Not causing trouble. And the Native Indian police, they finally released him. And so I got him back in the section. So that worked out.
So, obviously we know what Ernie did for entertainment. What sort of things did you do in your off time, in your downtime there?
Well, there was not much that you could do. After we'd been there over a year, we finally got a swimming pool built so you could swim. But other than that, you know, you couldn't do much. You were not permitted, with this peep, I wasn't permitted to drive into town or anything with this local. We had, in addition to these warehouses, we had what was called a revetment.
Okay.
And that's a block in diameter with a 20-foot pile of dirt all around. And the reason we had that is for large airplane parts, flaps, tail sections, that we couldn't get into the warehouses. So one day, there was an emergency formation call. This Colonel Byers, who was the supply officer for the whole bomber command, he said in the formation, he said, there's a plane left 10 to China, bombed Tokyo, got back, refueled, and left 10 to, and about 200 miles out, they had to ditch. The plane was not. Mm-hmm. So he said, when they ditched, they landed in the grass, and he said, it buckled the flaps. So he said, we got to get flaps and get them to that plane that's down. And he's saying, Sergeant Stafford, he said, I want you to go to that revetment and get the flaps. So he says, I'll get you a truck and I'll get you some help. And so I ran to the truck, and it was late in the afternoon, and this driver drove me to the revetment, and it had that 20-foot pile of dirt. And I thought, it's getting late in the day, and to find those flaps in that block place is not going to be real easy or real quick. And I just hit the top of the dirt pile, and there was a Gurkha.
A Gurkha?
A Gurkha. They're John Wayne-sized Indians. They all come from North India.
Okay.
And he had his gun right on me, just like this.
Really?
And I thought, I'm to get the flaps, and he's not going to let me go. He hit me head, put my hands up. And I thought, you know, what can this guy do? And I could see his gun was a octagon gun, like I'd learned to shoot in target practice early in the war. He had that as a bolt action gun. And I thought, you know, this guy isn't the enemy. He's a Gurkha. He's in the Indian service. And I had my hands up, and I kept thinking, and I made various motions, and he kept saying, Name Alam Saab, meaning, I don't understand. And I thought, well, I kept signaling like this. And he said, yeah, you can take one hand down. So I thought, God, whatever is in that wallet, make it be good. And what came out was, it said, you are a member of AAA Automobile Insurance. You're a member in good standing. And it said, you've been a member in good standing for 5 years, so we're awarding you a gold star. And I showed that to that Gurkha. He looked at it, and his mustache finally turned up, and he says, Acha, Saab, Min, very good. I knew he couldn't read.
So
anyway,
your AAA got you out of trouble.
Yep, we got the flaps. This tells about where I stopped on the way back.
This is on the way back to the States?
Yeah. And I
okay. Before we get you back home, when you were there, you were living in the tents. You said you had the swimming pool, and that was your entertainment. And you were riding back and forth. Now, you mentioned before we started the interview that your wife was back in the States. You got married just before you went into the service.
Yes.
And she was pregnant?
She followed me at several, at all the bases before I went overseas. And she did she deserves a lot of credit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the places she couldn't be with me.
Right.
She'd get a job in the PX. You know, I'd go to the PX and I could see her because she was working there. So that way she got on the base and I could see her. So she did a lot of wonderful things. Very good person, good woman.
But you said she was pregnant with your first child when you had to leave.
When I left, yes.
How far along was she at the time? Had she just found out? Or?
Well, I left in the... We went overseas in the end of 8 of 43.
Okay.
And the baby was born in February 44.
Okay.
And it's now, she and her husband are both retired.
So
that's the daughter that lives in Virginia.
So you didn't get to see your baby
until she was
a year and a half?
Not quite, but pretty well. It was from February, a year, and then when I got home in May of 45.
Had you gotten pictures of her?
I don't have them with me.
No, but had you taken pictures, had your wife sent you pictures of her?
Yes. I have a picture that this buddy of mine that's still living kept when I came home, and he made a frame out of Indian mahogany to put that baby picture in. So yes, I have a picture of him.
Very nice. So you were anxious to get home. You had a lot waiting for you at home.
Yes.
So you were, how long had you been in India altogether?
Well, it wasn't quite a year and a half. I was gone overseas a year and a half.
Right.
Less the transportation time going and coming. Coming back, I don't know if you want to hear that route or
not. Sure. You have a list here of the places that you...
Yeah, that's the whole list of where I was.
Karachi and Cairo and Tripoli and Marrakesh and the Azores, Newfoundland, and then to New York. And it looks like it took about 5 days or 6 days?
More. I was delayed in several places for several days.
Did you go back on a ship?
No, I flew.
You flew back?
I flew back on a war-weary DC-4.
Okay.
The ship had to, the airplane had to be sent back to Washington for repairs.
Okay.
So we flew that halfway around the world.
How many of you were on the plane?
Well, maybe 20, or see, it wasn't a regular passenger plane.
Right.
You had to sit on a parachute sideways.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a row each side of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And we had another experience, maybe you'll like to hear. When we came across, that we left Cairo and we're going into Tripoli, I looked out and I thought, gee, we're only 50 feet off the ground. And then we came over the Mediterranean Sea, and I could hear the pilots. There was two pilots and a co-pilot. A third pilot was sneaking his way home, but there were three in the cockpit. And they got cussing each other, they said. And I couldn't hear all the words, what they were saying. So we went over the desert and out over the Mediterranean, circled back around, and they're still yelling at each other. And finally, they landed. When the plane stopped, nobody did anything. So I opened the side door and I thought, we're about 200 feet from a cliff. Like this. And what they were cussing each other, the brakes went out on the airplane.
Oh.
So they decided, they should land it into the wind, but how could they stop it? So they quit cussing each other when it stopped. And I looked out, and I thought, oh, boy, we were so close to going over that cliff.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what happened at Tripoli. So I got to see Newfoundland and the Azores and New York. And then I went by rail from there to Chicago area.
Now, were you discharged?
No, I had to sign an agreement. This happened, this trip, when the war was over in Europe.
Okay.
May of 45.
Right.
So they said, well, the squadron commander said, you know, we can send part of you home on a 45-day leave if you've got a good enough reason. They said, write your request. So I wrote mine. I said, I have a daughter that's almost a year and a half old. I've never seen her. My wife was okay, but living in temporary quarters. So I was accepted to go home. Well, 10% of the squadron could go home on 45-day leave. At that same time, the squadron was transferred. The war was over in Europe. It's transferred out into the
Pacific.
Out into the Pacific. We retook. Let's see, the Philippines don't show up on here. But anyway, we retook the Philippines and Saipan, Guam, and Tinian were the bases that our planes all left India and were transferred to that base. This base was 1,200 miles from Tokyo. We were 4,000 miles from Tokyo here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the Enola Gay flew from, was Tinian,
right,
to Japan and dropped the bomb. Well, they flew there twice.
Mm-hmm. So you were, you went home. And got, where was home at that point? Was it still in Michigan?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So your
wife and daughter were in Michigan.
Yes. And my sister and her husband, he was a farmer, were in Michigan. And so my wife lived with a friend of my mother's, who was a widow lady, with the baby.
So they were...
So, do you have room for one more story?
Absolutely.
Okay. This isn't regarding my military service, but I think it might be of interest to you. And it runs like this. When I was 3 years old, my father was a dairy farmer. He and his brother and his father had the largest dairy farm in Huron County, Michigan. So at 33 years old, my dad died. He had a brain hemorrhage. And so we were moved into town with my mother's folks, my older sister, my younger brother, and I. So my grandfather, he had several interesting experiences. He had a Scottish watch, gold watch, big pocket watch. It was a watch where you press the stem, the front opens up, you can tell the time. And you press it again, the back opens up, you wind it with a key.
Okay.
So when I was 3 years old, I sat on his lap and he's telling me about this watch. And he wanted to teach me to tell time. Well, I hadn't been to school yet. I didn't know numbers. And further, the numbers on that watch were Roman numerals. So I never got straight on that. But anyway, many times he held me on his lap. And he said, now, when I'm through with this watch, I want you to have it. Well, about 20 years later, he passed on. And I found when his estate was settled, I didn't get the watch. The watch went to my cousin, who was 3 years older than I, and I'm sure my granddad forgot what he promised
right.
me. And the eldest grandson got the watch. Well, Lee Wallace was my grandson. Was 3 years older than I. He went to West Point, became an Army officer, and during the war, he was with MacArthur in Australia, and
okay.
they started moving north. They retook New Guinea, and at Kwajalein, he was involved in the invasion. He got to be a company. Well, he got to be a major then. Later, he was a colonel, and he was involved in attacking this island. So at one night, two cruisers set off, and they're firing 6-inch shells into the edge of this island. It was shaped like a horseshoe. And in the morning, the landing craft came around and approached the beach, charged the beach, dropped the front gate, and Lee ran off onto that island, and he was shot. Just when he got out of the water, he fell there. I wasn't there, but he lay there for 2 hours, bled badly. And so they finally took the edge of the island, and they set up a tent for people that were wounded.
Right.
And this doctor cleaned Lee up, and he said, "You're a lucky man." He said, "When you were shot, the bullet hit your watch." And he said, "It glanced. Otherwise, it would have severed your spine."
Wow.
He said, "It glanced and it went out your side."
So there's a reason he
had
that watch.
Well, Lee wrote me in India, and he said, he was short on words, he said, "Granddad's watch stopped." And I thought, "Well, that's strange. I just, you know, it's an older watch now." And later he told me that he got shot. They never did get all the parts of that watch out of his side.
So the watch was still in his body? Parts were still in his body?
Parts of it, yeah. They never got it all out. But the watch was up, out of commission. Well, later Lee got to be a full colonel, and he was the military attaché to the Shah of Iran.
Okay.
Iran is now turned anti-U.S., but anyway, at that time, the Shah was very pro-U.S., so Lee had quite an experience there. He passed away in 83, but he got through the war, okay.
Well, speaking of watches, did you ever get your bull of a watch back from that?
Yes.
You did?
I never did tell you that. Yeah, it was about 2 months later that watch arrived in India. APO, New York, New York, and they sent it to me in India, and I used it for several years after that. Yes, so the jeweler in Cape Town was honest. He did send my watch.
Well, good. So you were telling us you went back to the United States. You went back to Michigan.
Yes.
And you were there, you had 45-day leave?
Then we reformed in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay. Did your wife go with you, or did she stay in Michigan?
She went with me part of the time. They had the flight set up from, it was north of San Francisco. We were to go to Hawaii, the Philippines. Oh, my squadron was moved.
Okay.
I didn't go to that island, but it was not far from Tinian. Guam was near.
Okay.
Guam. So I had agreed to go back there, so we were forming the outfit to go back, and we were together in Salt Lake City, Utah, Kearns, Utah. So I went there, and I was there maybe 2 weeks, and they dropped the first bomb. Mm-hmm. So they said, "All shipments are stopped. You don't have to go back to Asia." And so a few days later, the second bomb was stopped and the war was over.
Right.
Well, I had enough. Everybody was graded on points.
Mm-hmm.
If you had enough points, you could get a discharge. I had enough points, you know, with my service and overseas time, we got double points. So I had enough points right away. So I was discharged in October 45. Well, whatever that says.
Yeah. In Salt Lake City?
In Salt Lake City, yes.
Okay. So from Salt Lake City, then you returned to Michigan?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Back to the movie theater business.
Back to the movie theater business. Okay. And you said your wife was with you in Utah? So she
went out there.
With your daughter?
There all together over 2 months. So she came out, and I'm trying to think. I think one of the grandparents took care of Anne, the baby,
okay,
when she came out.
Okay.
She stayed a short time with me.
Okay. When you got home from India, your wife knew you were coming?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What was it like when you got back to the United States after being in India, after being in that other culture for so long?
A whole different world, you know. I can't tell you what it's like to live in a tent that long.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you think, well, you go to the kitchen, oh no, we don't have any kitchen. You go to the bathroom, well, it's way down at the end of the latrine that's
right
down at the end of the all the tents. Very different life. So it's quite a relief to get back to civilization again.
When you were in India, were you eating food that was traditionally Indian, or were you eating American food, or a little of both?
We had a what do you call a sergeant that's in charge of the food.
Okay.
We had trouble getting food. I remember there was some beef sent in from South America.
Okay.
And some of my coolies helped unload it. And,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't lasting very long, but anyway, we had it.
And with something.
Yeah.
So when you first got home from India, you were staying at your wife's family's house?
My wife stayed with
a friend
of my mother.
A friend, that's right.
And I think I stayed there for a short time, and then we rented an apartment.
You rented a place.
Cass City, Michigan.
Okay.
And that's where one of the theaters were that I was managing, but I wasn't a partner in that theater.
So what was the first thing you did when you got home?
Well, I met my wife in Detroit. She was back home first. And so we were together for that day. Drove 100 miles up to Cass City, rejoined the family. It was an adjustment to get back in the civilian life again.
And how was it holding your baby girl for the first time?
She could just start to walk. And at the apartment, well, my wife had rented this apartment just before, I think, and there was a garden. And my wife thought she'd plant a few things. So I took my daughter out to the garden, and it was too rough.
Uh-huh, too uneven.
She'd walk a few steps and fall down. And so I was picking her up and cry a little bit. So it was an adjustment.
So as you said, you went back to managing the movie theaters, and you
yes
had the partnership.
Yes.
And you later got into real estate in Illinois, and you're now retired.
Yes.
Did you make any friendships with guys that you still keep in touch with?
Yes. Last count, I think, was 9 out of 121 in our squadron. It's all living, you know.
Do you have regular reunions, or
did we? We did for many years. And, there's only one fellow that I was able to see in the last year, and he lives in Indiana, about halfway down Indiana. It would be like west of Indianapolis.
Okay.
And my daughter and son-in-law drove me down to Kankakee. We met there, had lunch together.
Oh, that was nice.
That was the last reunion. And, I wanted to do it again, and his wife wasn't able to come, so we had to cancel. So we might get together one more time. Another buddy in Saginaw, Michigan, is not able to travel now either. He had a, what do you call it, stent put in.
A stent put in, right.
But I've known him in both for a very long time.
Have you joined any veterans organizations?
No.
No? You just had your own reunions.
Yes. And we met at several places in like Arizona, New Mexico. Some of the fellows were from there, and arranged for facilities, mm-hmm. rental
right.
places, and so on. So that worked out several times. When my wife was living, we went there for the reunion.
How did your military experiences affect your thinking about war, about the military in general?
Well, I felt, you know, Hitler was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the idea of fighting a war was the best solution
mm-hmm.
we could come up with. And I don't think that so much about Vietnam.
Okay.
And I think that even less about what's going on in Iraq today. I think
right.
we've got more enemies now than we had before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unfortunate that that war was ever started, I think.
So some wars may be necessary, but some we get into that are harder to justify.
Yes. And to state what religious wars went on, is, you know,
mm-hmm.
is kind of a tough subject, I think.
Right. How did your service and the experiences you had there affect your life in general? Your way of thinking, thinking of life and what you did.
I respected the military. And when we came to Vietnam, my two sons, neither were in service, and neither had to go in service.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't trying to avoid it. My one son had a physical problem that didn't qualify him for service. But I respect the military, and I think it's unfortunate now that more people don't volunteer for it.
Mm-hmm.
We're having problems now.
Right. Did it have an effect on your life? Did your military service have an effect on your life after the military?
Well, I think so.
In what way?
Well, I think it's 3.5 years of my life that were completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know, like a fun thing to do.
Right.
It was seemingly a necessary thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But to say that I choose that type of activity, no, I wouldn't.
Okay. Is there anything that we haven't covered in the interview that you'd like to add before we finish?
I think I pretty well told you the story.
Okay. Well, in that case, thank you very much for sharing your story, and we're going off record.
Okay.